Hi, my name's Clover, and you're listening to the Force of Nature podcast. This season, we're diving into Confessions of a Climate Activist. What comes to mind when you picture an activist? Is it a person glued to the road? Someone with a reusable coffee cup? Maybe a teenager holding a microphone? Whatever it is, I want you to let it go, because I'm about to invite you behind the scenes. You're going to hear from activists on the stuff that doesn't get talked about. Burnout. Getting cancelled, the ethical compromises of making money, imposter syndrome, and even what it's like to alienate friends and family. See this as your how-to guide when understanding and navigating the nuances of activism, as well as the barriers to action in the climate space. Over the season, we hope to find some answers, namely, what activism can look like when it's more open, honest, and human. Make sure to stick around to the end of each episode when our guests spill their climate confessions. After all, we don't need 100 perfect activists, but millions of imperfect ones. Last week on Confessions of a Climate Activist, we met Sophia Chiani and discussed the scrutiny faced by activists, especially on social media. We also talked about identity and drawing a line between our work and our personal lives. I've been vegetarian for over a decade, yet I've not brought it up at my family's dinner table for years. When we're together, meat is ordered from the menu in hushed tones, with pointed glances toward me. I'm quick to beat everyone to the rabbit food punchline and smile good-naturedly when a bowl of limp lettuce arrives. I'm sent a daily deluge of climate articles from one family member and climate conspiracy films by another. When I traveled to see a family member for the first time in 2 years, they asked me if I wasn't a hypocrite for calling myself an activist while continuing to fly. I'm also not sure when I became the climate confessional among my friends. First to be told about the new iPhone, the lack of recycling bins, how they relapse during Veganuary. I'd much rather talk about literally anything else. So compliment an outfit, only to elicit another confession of which fast fashion shop they purchased it from. Sometimes I've made up my own climate confessions to erase the guilty expressions from their faces. Today, we're talking about navigating personal dynamics within activism, from losing friends over ideological differences to difficult dinner table conversations with family. Before we go to our interviews, I want to hear from the Force of Nature community about how they deal with some of these challenges. This is what they had to say.
Difficult conversations are bound to happen with family and friends, and I've definitely experienced this. Behavior change is always a bit hard to discuss because it becomes a slight attack on someone's way of living. One of the trickiest conversations I have is around diet. It can be really disheartening to experience those conversations with families and friends, especially when you feel like you're not making any progress. And especially if you're the only one doing it, quite easy to see yourself as the outsider. But the key is to find a way to talk about it in a non-combative way. The key is convincing people.
A lot of older people I try and talk to about it, including family, just don't take it very seriously and often roll their eyes when I try to talk about the latest demonstration I've been on or campaign I've been a part of. It's so tiring. The more you learn about how corrupt and unjust the people at the top are, it increasingly feels more like you can't do much. But together, I think we can.
My name's Katie. I'm 15. I'm from Yorkshire. I like to think I'm a climate activist. Once I had a conversation with my grandparents. I told them that solar energy is 9 times cheaper than gas, so why is the government still subsidising it? My granddad replied with, "What if it isn't sunny?" I might have read him wrong here, but in my head it sounded like he's trying to defend fossil fuels. It sounds like he thinks humans can't live without them. And to me that's heartbreaking. I fight for climate justice, or I try to, and granddad is totally undermining everything I do. It's heartbreaking. He asked me where I got that information. I said from Friends of the Earth, and he said that I should stop listening to propaganda. Heartbreaking. I meant to look up to my elders.
I really relate to this pressure to inform and influence the people in our lives. but also how this can complicate our relationships. When we polled our Force of Nature community, 96% of them said that talking about the issues they cared about had affected their personal relationships. Many expressed feeling sad, confused, disappointed, frustrated, and alienated after these difficult conversations. Now, no one wants to be that caricature of the annoying, preachy activist, but when we're so passionate about these issues, and when they feel so urgent, which they are, it can be really, really difficult to toe this line. To explore this with me, I've invited my friend Jamie Windust onto the show. I'll let Jamie introduce themselves.
So I am Jamie Windust. I am a writer, author, and editor, and I specialize in telling LGBTQ plus stories through my written work, through video, through social media.
And Jamie, I'd love to know, would you consider yourself an activist? Like, is that a term that you use personally?
I found it a really interesting idea and almost synopsis for this episode when I was reading through it, because I really like to look back on that word activist in my trajectory and my life, because it was never something that I called myself. It was something that, and in many ways, like a lot of things in society or a lot of social constructs almost, it was something that was kind of placed upon me as, here is someone saying things that other people may not have heard. They are an activist. And then I kind of quickly ran with it and just kind of embodied it without knowing really what it meant for a long time. And then I went through a period of kind of dismissing it, you know, and saying, actually, no, I'm not. So no, I would never say I am. And definitely nowadays, I would not.
Was there a definitive time where you decided, like, no, this word does not represent, like, who I am or what I do?
Yeah, definitely. I think there was a period of time in my late teens, just as I moved to London. So I moved to London at 18, and I'd come out as non-binary, and I was experiencing really just like my first full immersion within the queer space physically. I'd existed in quite a rural part of the UK before then. I'd not had any physical queer community space. And so that kind of led me into my love of storytelling. So I started thinking about what career I wanted to do. And I ended up at the end of my degree looking into media and journalism and using that as like a space to tell queer stories. Around that time is when I started a petition to essentially very kindly ask the government if they could remove the binary male and female markers on passports and official documentation. That was my first foray into what I would see as, like, you know, quite a traditional activist trajectory. Like, that was a time when I was being called an activist. I kind of did sit in that role. I was being quite vocal. I had a very specific mission. And then later on, I moved into kind of taking that cloak off, as it were. I think in those early days, being in that space, I just didn't really know what I was doing. I had imposter syndrome. I didn't know whether or not the campaign was actually going to achieve anything. I knew that there was another campaign going alongside mine that had been going for many years and was actually around the same time. So this is like 2017, 18, was going to the High Court. So I knew that there was movement. It was passed on to the larger campaign, and it reached the threshold for a response from government. And, you know, that campaign is, I'm not involved in that anymore, but that campaign is still going on to this day. And I guess leading on from this, being really heavily into this activist space, to then kind of taking a step back, one of the reasons why that was actually, I hadn't engaged fully with all aspects of my community on what they thought of this campaign and whether or not it was actually impactful for everyone and positively impactful. And I think really speaking to people who, for example, asylum seekers or people of color or certain people who just for whatever reason, personal to them, didn't want the government knowing that they identified as non-binary. Because if you know, the whole part of my petition was that you would be able to identify as such on official documentation. By proxy, the government would then know how you identified. And it was really interesting to take myself out of this kind of streamlined way of thinking of, like, everyone must want this because they can't do it. Whereas actually there was a large proportion of people that said, we don't actually, this isn't something that I want to do. And that was really interesting to me to think, okay, that's so important. You know, that's something that I've missed. I've been quite blindsided by my own my own outlook. You know, I had not explored enough. And I found that really interesting to sit with and to think, you know what, I actually agree with that to an extent. And that was the kind of beginning of me stepping back.
I'd love to hear, backing up even further, you know, it's clear even in the creation of that petition that you were someone who, like, you know, speaks out in the face of injustice, and you're someone who wants to put yourself in the ring, and you are a kind of like natural advocate. I'd love to hear in what ways that was informed by your own like lived experience in the years that led up to that moment.
It's really interesting because a lot of my work that I do now, and especially in that period of time, petition time, and like as I was being really vocal, if you look back, it seems really odd that I'm the person to do that, because I was notoriously quiet from like birth till 16. Like I was always the one that said, that had in their like school reports, like needs to speak up more. I didn't socialize, you know, I wasn't loud. You know, I've spoken to other people about this. I think sometimes people see it as like a slight snapping. You know, being quiet doesn't mean you don't have something to say. It just means you may be fearful to say it, or you're not in a safe environment to be able to say it. And I think when I then left my hometown and school, and then I ended up in London, I then felt like I had permission to say things I wanted to say, and start exploring things that I didn't necessarily feel safe doing so before. And so it's almost like the floodgates opened and I became really loud.
And Jamie, you've spoken online as, you know, someone in the public eye about the negative sides of social media, and the not just like criticism, but like outright trolling, which from what I've seen online is like most often hurled toward the trans community. It's like next level, the kind of like hate and just the fact that it's constantly somehow up for public debate, like the rights of the trans community and the LGBT community at large. How have you navigated some of that, being someone who does have a platform today?
Yeah, good question. I think that it's something that I came across recently, actually, and the wonderful writer Sean Fay shared a few months ago about this idea of like digital self-harm, like knowing that you may receive negative comments or that your community may receive them at large, but still kind of being sucked into this vortex of like wanting to look. And that is where I think even up until now, you know, recently, as in like, you know, 2 or 3 weeks ago, I took a step back from Twitter for a bit, which I do kind of occasionally, just because there was a lot of quite specific commentary on a piece of film that I'd done a few years ago, and that had resurfaced and people were kind of attacking that. And I think there's a real pull in me to know what people are saying. And, you know, I'm sure you're aware of this as well in your work. Social media, for a lot of people, just kind of becomes an inadvertent job that they then have. It's like you're suddenly a content creator because you have a message. And so that makes it hard because you want people to join in what you're doing and support what you're doing and that urgency, but you also need to be able to look after yourself. So yeah, just being really strict, you know, that's the only way it can work. It's a tough one as well. I think one thing that I did think about recently with the, when I received the trolling on Twitter, is there was like loads of people who had seen this video. A fair few people were commenting, but like, you know, this person had shared a video and it received like, you know, 100,000 or whatever views. Since when in a time have people been openly able to know that like hundreds of thousands of people don't like them? Like that's just not a thing that generations prior have known.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of what you're alluding to as well, is like the moment you are kind of like outspoken or you're given a platform, it's like suddenly there is license for people to just like pile on. It's like, okay, well, you know, you're up for grabs now, so I can say whatever and like not, yeah, consider that there's possibly a human being on the other side like reading every comment. And I think at that point, what I find really hard is to like kind of, yeah, reflecting what you were saying about like having those moments of kind of looking around you and being like, are these the people? For me, like those comments on Twitter the ones that like really hurt are the ones that are kind of like echoes of what people in my real life have said to me at one point or another, because they can kind of like validate them and they can make them more real, and they can also like unearth a lot from my own personal experience in activism that I probably like haven't processed because it's really hard. But I guess to that, I'd love to hear, you know, from your own personal experience, does any of that criticism that you've received online ever like echo what people in your immediate life have said to you?
Yeah, I think the biggest one that I get a lot is that that from outside of my inner circle, that I have had at times from my inner circle, is this idea of like being too much or being like too self-centered. And I don't mean that in like that I'm a really like a really selfish person, but in terms of like, for example, the way that I looked, I used to get a lot of attention for potentially people saying like, you draw so much attention to yourself, what do you expect? Like, you're going to get this negative reaction because of your identity. And I did used to receive that from you know, certain people in my inner circle or certain members of my family who would kind of essentially victim blame and kind of say like, you know, you do, if you're going to do this, and by this I mean just exist, then you're going to receive a negative reaction and that's your fault, which they're essentially saying is you could change if you wanted to, but you don't because you love the attention. That was really tough, and that is something I still get nowadays. If someone you don't know is saying something to you that actually people who do know you have said the same thing, it's kind of like, oh, maybe people are right.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I know that was like a big turning point for me with like certain family members. I have a sister who's a climate change conspiracy theorist and a dad who makes some pretty big digs about like my activism, my work. I remember it was a really big turning point where I was like, oh, I don't actually have an obligation to like continue placing myself in situations or inserting myself into conversations that are just like going to be really hurtful. And I think something as well that I've observed, at least for myself, is like once activism kind of becomes your identity and then you're known as like, for me, like the climate change person, then you can get roped into things. You're like, I don't even want to have this conversation. Like, I don't even want to participate in this exchange. But it's like, you know, there's the quiet nod to something or the underhand comment. And just like being able to sit above that or like not even put myself in that situation in the first place has been so, so positive, like for my mental health and just my sustainability being able to do this work. I guess on that more positive note, is there a piece of advice that you would give to your younger self? Sorry, this is a horribly cliched question, but like, is there a piece of advice you'd give yourself, knowing what you know now about the spaces you've shown up in and how you, you know, identify as an actor, how you do this work? You know, what's a message that you might impart to your younger self or to any young person who's wanting to engage in this space?
But what I see from young people is there's so much fire and there's so much passion. And I think what's made me so excited about the young people specifically at the moment is this shift in how vocal they're being about climate change, and how actually that is kind of started as quite almost like an epicenter, and it is flowing out into lots of other social realms. And I think what I always say to these young people when they, you know, they ask for advice, or they say, you know, when parents ask for advice for the young people, or again, as you say, what would I say to myself, is to take your time finding out who you are first and not existing as someone who you think other people want you to be. For example, like, I never got to come out at school because people presumed that I was gay. And so that moment was kind of taken away from me. And I didn't get to have ownership over my identity. I just kind of became something that other people thought I was. And then I ended up kind of fulfilling that stereotype. The same with my activist work in the early days, you know, when I was 18, 19, I became what other people wanted me to be because I thought that that's what I needed to be at the time. But I didn't actually get a lot of opportunity to process who I was or what my identity was. And so I think, although identity is always ever changing, it's really important that you come to terms with who you are and process who you are in your own terms for you first, and then use it if you want to shine a light on the rest of your community.
Oh, that was such good advice. I would have bottled that up and listened to it every day. Very final question. It's a bit of a silly one. Taking a leaf out of the book of our friends at the Climate Curious podcast, we're inviting people to share their climate confessions. In the interest of normalizing imperfect activism, my most recent climate confession would probably be the number of Ubers that I've been taking around the city. I've been justifying them in my head because I'm like, oh, I get like agoraphobic sometimes and I don't like sitting on the bus or like taking public transport, but it's like pure convenience and like self-interest that has me ordering that Uber. Do you have a climate confession you would like to share?
You know what? I would say it's very similar. But I have a car. I didn't know that I'd love this, but I just love driving. Like if I'm doing something in like Manchester or like the north of England, and they're like, "Oh, well, do you want to get the train?" I'll outright refuse. I'll be like, "No, no, I will be driving. I'd love it. I will spend like a day in the car. Yeah, that would be mine."
Oh, well, thank you so much, Jamie. This has been such a wonderful conversation. I'm truly very grateful for your time.
I really appreciated Jamie's honesty about the journey they've been on and how in the early days of their activism, they struggled with the expectations placed on them to be and also represent someone they weren't. Another theme that came up within our community is the sort of cognitive dissonance of waking up to the climate crisis while continuing to navigate our day-to-day lives. I've invited my friend Fainty Balligan to explore this with me. Here he is.
Hi, my name's Fainty Balligan. I trained as an actor, so I do a lot of that. I do a lot of public speaking as much as possible in public and in private, that being like businesses or back rooms of places, because we live in a climate emergency and it doesn't feel like that unless you're keyed into it. So I talk a lot about climate. I talk a lot about social justice, racial justice, and other sort of intersectional themes amongst the climate thing. And so it's like writing, making theatre, speaking, acting, kind of making sure that everything is connected, trying to. That's my shtick, I think.
How did you first come into the climate world?
As I said, trained as an actor. So I kind of started jobs in theatre. I did my first job at the RIC. And I want to do a good job. I want people to rate me and to see that I'm brilliant. And so you do all the research. And part of the research on this thing was to read up about climate change, because it was a climate change sort of farce. I didn't really know anything about climate change at the time, other than James Cameron's Avatar, which made me feel like I wanted like a Na'vi tale. Then I started reading This Changed Everything by Naomi Klein, and my world was fucked up. God damn. Oh, it really killed my vibe, man. Such a mood killer. But it was like, it was hard, because you go about your life and everything's normal, and then someone just says something and you start noticing stuff and you're like, oh, hold on, that isn't normal. And then you start realizing that, I think it's the same when anybody gets into any type of activism or like social justice or like is hungry for justice, is that they see it more and then they get angry when people don't see it. So it's like, it's fury. I found it just infuriating that people could go to Sainsbury's or Tesco's or like live their normal life and not like scream or shout or start a riot or like, I didn't understand it. So I got very, I don't want to say depressed, morose. I got very morose. I found it difficult to leave my bedroom. I found it difficult to communicate with other people. I was just carrying, all of a sudden, within, you know, a couple of days, this heavy load. So I made a decision to stop eating meat and stop buying plastic. And those were going to be my two individual things that I was going to do to help fight the climate crisis. Because that's how I've been told I'm going to fight it. Recycle more. Don't eat me stop buying plastic. So all those three things were like, those things I'm going to do. And then I can go on to Oscar Road. That's the road, baby. So back to the focus. Go do some more plays, get my first lead in the West End. And then I start experiencing climate anxiety. I was like, yo, this is such a mood killer. Like, god damn. I'm here, this thing I've worked for, to be a lead in the West End, to lead a show, to do this thing, and I'm thinking about climate. We had the hottest summer in history at that point, before, you know, last summer, and I think it was like 2017, and I remember I sat outside with my director, and the director was like, we were kind of talking about something, and I was like, oh, isn't this weird? Like, all the grass is dead, and this is like weird, right? He was like, no, let's just get on, don't worry about that. And so he goes inside, and I was just stuck with that image, that sort of thing in my head. And again, this is the reinforcement of seeing the dissonance. It's like, we live in a place that is really being affected, is dying, is being massively affected by the changes in climate and all these systemic things that are leading to it. But because we live within that system, we have to go inside and continue rehearsal. There is no reward or room for inquiring as to why this looks the way it looks. For my director, he needed to deliver for producers. He needed to make sure there was a good show. He needed to make sure that we were producing something that was excellent. So he'd go on and do, 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 do. There's no room in that to be like, oh, hold on, let's wait a second. What the fuck is going on? Again, so my brain, my subconscious is like tweaking, right? I want to do a good show. This is what I trained to do. So I go back into rehearsal. I keep doing that thing, but at the back of my head, I'm like, what is going on? Start experiencing panic attacks, anxiety dreams, all of this different stuff. Again, doing this dream job. And I'm like, okay, I have to do something. So fast forward, I start protesting. I joined Extinction Rebellion because I was doing a job and I found them on like Twitter or something, and they were doing like a talk, and I was like, oh, this is interesting, I'll go to this. And it was the first time I was in a room of people that felt like me, and it was like, whoa, this is huge, this is really huge. And I started protesting, I started organizing all of these different things, and I went away to do this job, and when I got back from the job, I got into an argument with my mum. My mum was like, why are you sacrificing your career to be part of these people? I was like, you don't understand, the whole world is in da 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 da. Got into an argument for a long while. I took my phone. I recorded the whole argument because I wanted to prove my mum wrong with her own words. I listened back to the recording. She had some very good points. And that's when I realized where I fit and what the answer was to my climate anxiety, which was finding where I was helpful in the movement. It's like, if the dream is a solar punk, like, equitable future with a circular economy that has, like, its focus on green energy and making sure everybody has enough and making sure we get rid of our xenophobia and all these other parts of society that really ruin us, and moving away from capitalism and creating this new ideal. If that's the goal for, you know, 20, 30 something or 20, 40 or 20 something, something, where do I fit on the road to that goal? It's like, okay, well, I'm an actor. I can speak really well. I jump social class all the time because of the rooms I'm in. And there are people I can speak on behalf of that can't be spoken for. So that's what I did. I made a lecture from my mum's recordings. I went to different communities around London. The lecture became a play. The play became a film. The film actually becomes another film. And we just go out and we keep talking, we keep connecting, we keep bringing it to the grassroots. That is a very long story long of how I got into what I'm doing and what I do.
And I think it's really interesting, this take on like having this conversation with your mom and then really listening to and understanding her arguments and then thoughtfully responding to them. But I'd love to hear, in some of the other conversations you had with people who were in your life and who weren't necessarily like in the quote unquote, you know, climate space or in Extinction Rebellion, like, how did you find navigating some of those conversations, whether they were with like colleagues and peers or friends and family? What was that experience like as you were simultaneously learning about this problem and also trying to communicate on it?
I had very different phases of my life. And I think it happens when you get into any type of activism. You've got the, I know there's injustice that exists and you should care about it too. Why don't you care? And then it's just like, oh, fuck, like, I'm annoyed at the world, I'm annoyed at everything, I'm annoyed at myself because no one cares as deeply and as passionately about the things that I care about, right? You move a little further on and you're like, okay, they got shit they need to worry about. And actually, maybe what I care about isn't what other people care about. Maybe there's a good reason for that. And that's part of what my mum was saying. My mum was talking about being black in the UK and what that means. And what she didn't realize she was talking about, she was like, when you come over to this country, you assimilate and you don't want to stand out. You don't want to be kicked out. You don't want to be ostracized. You don't want to get things taken away from you because often and too easily they are. Very simple. We know about the systemic racism that exists. We know about it sitting in our subconscious, about the way we think about people, things like it's there, it's there. When you grow up with that, you sort of clued into it a bit more. When your mum has it and she teaches you, she's clued into it way, way more. So there's all this other stuff. And I'm like, yeah, but that's not important. Of course it is, Fainty, actually. Of course it is, because climate change isn't the problem. That's the thing that changed for me. Climate change isn't the problem. Climate change is a symptom of the problem. Climate change wouldn't exist if it didn't make someone money. In the same way, a lot of insecurities about how we look wouldn't exist if it didn't make certain like beauty companies and this and that money, right? If all, everyone was just okay with themselves and it was about actually feeling good and health, it'd be a very different economy on that messaging. Especially when you go to sort of like the sexist tropes and all of this, and then the patriarchal trope. It goes on and on and on and on and on and on because it's useful for the way system exists at the minute. So if you factor in all those things and all of a sudden my big issue, right, that overtakes everything becomes actually a smaller issue, becomes the same size as everybody else's issues. It then becomes about talking to people where they're at, speaking to them about the things that they are really, really worried about, right? And linking that to the thing that I'm worried about because it's just the same issue and I actually want to fight in the same people. And when you travel along that journey, it's not about you're wrong or I'm right, or you're getting it wrong, or you're not doing it right, or you don't care. It's about, here's where we need to go. I'm just going to push you there a little bit. I always say when you're talking to family, family's the hardest one. Family's the hardest one. They're too close. Too close. I don't like intimacy. I love it, sort of. But with family, it's like a shoreline to a rock face. You're trying to make a beach. And it takes a long time to just erode at that rock face and make the beach, right? And with family, that's what you have to do because they are so close. These people are your people and sometimes don't see the things you do. So you just have to chip away bit by bit and bit by bit and bit by bit. And you also have to understand, how much energy do I have?
Oh, that was amazing. There is so much there. I'm like, I wish I had a pen and paper so I could have taken notes on that. But the first thing I wanted to acknowledge, yeah, just what you were sharing around like the depth of kind of grief. And I think that journey that you described is one that a lot of kind of activists or just like people who care also go on, particularly from this moment of like, oh my God, this thing is huge. It's overwhelming. Like all of the fear and anxiety and grief and sadness that can kind of like bubble up. But then this realization that like, oh, when I'm talking about climate anxiety, I'm not just talking about like, you know, fear of the quote unquote climate crisis or inaction in the face of it. Like my body, my soul is like responding to the culture that I'm in. And it's a culture that makes it fundamentally difficult to do the right or quite responsible thing. And I loved as well what you were speaking to in terms of like how you try to like communicate all of that, which is like going on inside of you. And I know for me, similarly, like it started with the, okay, well, what are the things I can do in my personal life? How do I instantly do something, right? Out of this kind of like place of desperation. And then it was like literally guilt tripping everyone in my personal life around me, being like, don't you care? Like, I know you're an empathetic person. Like, why don't you care about these things? Like, why don't you participate in the stuff that's important? And then getting to that point of like, oh, wow, I'm inconsistent. We're all inconsistent. But also, again, we're all part of the system. And the goal isn't to point the finger at the person next to me. The goal is to actually like examine the systems and the structures that we're a part of and invite people to participate, starting with where they're at, exactly as you said. Like, because it also comes from such a place of privilege to be like, yeah, here's another thing for you to care about. And for example, so many people in this country being like, I'm just focused on like keeping the lights on and making sure I can put food on the table, right? And send my kids to school. And that's why we can't allow the conversation to get like too caught up in the clouds. It has to be like, how do we connect people to this problem as something that affects them day to day, but also to frame it as like a way to make everyone's lives better as well. I guess my second to last question for you, Fainty, would just be, given this journey you've been on, like falling into the well of despair, not feeling particularly held in those feelings, and then coming to a point where you're using your voice, you're inspiring other people, you're bringing other people into the movement, how sustainable does your activism feel at this point? Like, how do you feel about where you're at now, looking back at where you've come from?
I got burnt out quite hard. 2021 was probably the busiest year of my entire life, maybe. And I, like, I've always been a person of like, you know, I'm an actor, like, the show must go on. Like, I broke a leg, I'll do it with one leg. Like, I can't see, I can sing now. Like, it's, we'll find a way to make it to the end. So, I had to learn that sometimes it's not a good thing. Like, I was doing crazy days, man. At one point, and I didn't mind it, at one point it was like 6 a.m. to like 2 a.m. for like a couple of weeks. And it was just, wow. And like, that went on and that was fine. And then I was filming for a bit. And then I was at COP. And then I was doing something else. And I developed all these different medical conditions that I'd never had before. I was like, yo, what's going on, man? It's like, are you stressed? I was like, not really. Like, this is just my life. And it's mad because, like I was saying earlier about writing, I'm in a period now where, you know, I'm not as busy. I don't know if I'm as busy and I'm just managing it better. But it's just like my body has learned lessons that my brain will not forget. And so in terms of being sustainable, and I assume you mean sustainable in the way of sustaining myself as probably as well as planetary sustainable, but like, I do push myself, but I don't think I go to the same level I did, because sometimes that's not useful. Sometimes it's not helpful. Sometimes something needs to get done, absolutely. But like, a day off is necessary in order to be alive. And it's mad, like, even now I'm still, you know, it's so hard to get out of this capitalist idea of being useful. Because I think, okay, what's the best way of me being useful is like, I take a day off and then I'll be loaded up for the rest of the week, because I love my work and I love what I do. But I think I do sustain myself more by knowing what I need to keep going. I think that's a really big thing. But I'm not there yet, man. Like, I am on the verge. Like, I'm leaving this and going straight to my next thing. You get me? Like, I've learnt lessons from going a bit too far over the edge, which I think is helping me get stable. I've got a long way to go.
Don't we all? We all have a long way to go. Okay, final question. This is a speed round. We're inviting everyone to In the interest of normalizing imperfect activism and inconsistent activism and kind of like poking fun at individual actions as well, we're inviting everyone to share a climate confession. So one way in which they find themselves being very human and inconsistent and hypocritical. As you can imagine, I've had to literally do this 10 times. So I've exposed every single one of my inconsistencies. There are so many. But I'm going to share one that was actually just inspired by what you were saying around rest and kind of burnout. And that is so often like the messages that I put out on social media could not be further from like the truth of how I practice my activism. And I think a very clear cut example of that is like rest. Like I remember in the same week I put out this like very vulnerable post about like rest is resistance and like having gotten burnt out and like learned my lesson and like let's not recreate these systems of capitalism, like simultaneously working like 14-hour days and getting like so ill eventually with like a bloody chest infection. Like it was horrible. But I do this all the time and it definitely makes me feel like a hypocrite because I'm like, oh, but just like everyone else can do it. Like this, the same rules don't apply to me. So that is my climate confession. Fainty, do you have any climate confessions you would like to share?
How much time you got? I've got so many climate confessions. Fucking hell. Yeah, overworking. Massive. Massive. I fight to find my community. I'm really productive on my own. And sometimes I'm inconsistent in the way that I can give. I say yes to everything. And that often means that I get very little done in terms of that. I'm an actor, so I travel a lot. I try and request trains, but planes come in often. Buying avocados, bro. Buying avocados, mad. They're fucking delicious. I know. You think I don't know? I know. I don't do it all the time. I do it though. Everything's surrounded in plastic. If I want salad, it's plastic. If I want friggin' like apples, it's in plastic. It's apples, it's in plastic. Lemons, plastic. Oil for cooking, plastic. So I'm surrounded by islands of plastic, planets of plastic, sponsored by me, which is infuriating. What else? Anything? I have loads of Apple products. I have an Apple phone. I'm on my Mac. There's an iPad over there. They're all secondhand. Let me not lie, but someone somewhere did not get paid a lot of money to make them, even though, you know, it came from like GameStop or whatever. I mean, the list kind of goes on. What's the worst one though? What's one that would be like, oh, that's not good? I think generally I am quite good, but it's probably how individualistic I actually am, like massively. Like I really tried to be in community, but for most of the part I'm not. For most of the part I'm on my ones, and I think I've adapted to working that way, as the most productive version of myself. And it's very hard for me to give in to a narrative. And I asked a question about what is community, and I know it's the answer. I ask the question because I'm trying to find the answer for myself, because it's really hard. It's really hard. It's really, really hard. That's my confession. I feel naked. There you go. Well done. Well done.
Oh, you've outdone yourself. That was amazing. That was every climate confession. That was essentially what I've had to do for every episode. Whereas like each time I'm like scraping the barrel because I'm in denial about my own inconsistency, and you were just like stream of consciousness, like let it go. You know you're deep when you know like the social environmental impact of an avocado. You're like, I am supporting like the cartel in South America. Like, this is terrible. I'm single-handedly creating the drought. But yeah, avocados are, they're so good. Yeah, it's so true. It's so true. I do all of the things that you mentioned as well. So if that makes you feel any better. Fainty, thank you so much. This has been such a wonderful conversation.
I love the fact that Fainty actually recorded a conversation with his mum, which created enough space for him to gain perspective on the conversation and really hear where she was coming from. Something that resonated from both Jamie and Fainty was how important it is to them to seek that acceptance and understanding from their families, but also realizing that there isn't an obligation for them to start conversations or put themselves in situations which might be actively harmful. It's this fine line between showing up as your whole self, with your thoughts and cares and values, while also safeguarding your well-being. So if you're an activist and you're worried that another Christmas dinner is about to be ruined by needing to defend your values and your work, please remember to be kind to yourself. It's important to engage with the people close to you, including your family, but it should not come at the expense of your mental health. On that theme, Fainty also spoke to his climate anxiety and the challenge of not only coming to terms with these feelings, but struggling to find a community who shared them. I want to explore this further, so for next week's episode, I've invited my friend Mitzi Janelle Tan, a trailblazing activist from the Philippines an all-round beautiful human being, to share her own climate story. In the meantime, if you've enjoyed today's episode and are thirsty for more Force of Nature content, you might want to check out episode 12 from season 2, where we dive into the role of education in solving the climate crisis. When you've listened, drop us a comment and let us know what you think. How did today's episode make you feel? Let us know by heading over to Force of Nature's Instagram at forceofnature.xyz and dropping us a comment. If you're between the ages of 16 and 35, you can join Force of Nature's growing online community and access our free programs and trainings, which help you develop the skills to take action. You can also find resources on our website. If you haven't already subscribed to the podcast, well, you know what to do. This show was brought to you by Force of Nature and One Fine Play. From One Fine Play, Kaz Refruzia is the editor and producer. Connor Foley is the producer and researcher. From Force of Nature, I'm your host, Clover Hogan, and this season would not be possible without Meg Stillwell and Isabel Flint.